Hello, ladies and gentlemen.
The following program contains language of an explicitly technical nature, which may be upsetting to some listeners.
Keep the dial right where it is, because this can be the most important day of your
life.
The
miracle of recording.
Those words were spoken by an electronic digital computer which was programmed to simulate a speaking machine.
This is the one time we'll have a picnic or two. On a carpet of flowers, neath a ceiling of blue, we could while away hours and have a picnic or two. We'll hug, we'll kiss, sample the lunch you made. I'll try your pie, cookies and lemonade. What a perfect day this is for proposing to you. When I make you the missus, oh, what a picnic for two.
Time for another podcast. Welcome along. Mostly music and an interview with Richard Reynolds, the Gorilla Gardener and Top Planner. And that's a kind of fitting bit of music to introduce him, really, because I interviewed him in a park and we didn't actually have a picnic, but it was there was two of us. He's a top bloke. Well worth listening to that. It starts off very badly with the audio because I pointed the mic at him and not at me, so I start off very quietly, but when he comes in you can actually hear him talking, so that's good. And then the other thing is all the music in this edition has a link from beginning to end, i.e. one track has a link to the next all the way through, and the person who spots it, spots all the links, will get a top secret t-shirt type prize, the exact nature of which I cannot reveal as yet, but will be revealed in a couple of weeks. So if you think you know the links, stick them in the comments. And on with the music.
Who's that girl? 'Cause I'm down by the law. It's the real deal. I'm down by law.
if you listen to any of them, you discover that I really fumble for a first question, and then you have conversation. So, why don't we start with? I've written about Guerrilla Gardening on the blog because it's fantastic, but also I just like the idea of planners that do stuff, and you are a planner that does stuff. So, what is the stuff that you do? That's a good question. Why don't we start?
Okay. I currently am spending a lot of time gardening and encouraging other people to garden in public space, which is what the guerrilla gardening thing is all about. But simultaneously, there are always other projects on the go. So I make t-shirts and I make records and I take lots of photographs. I go around the country tasting tap water, which is a project that I do hope can turn into something more significant at some point. Those are the ones with logos.
Right, okay, that was what I was going to say, because you don't just make t-shirts, you kind of have a t-shirt brand. Basically.
Yes, that's right, it's a t-shirt brand, and it's called Good at Magic, because most of the designs are about celebrating something that I think is pretty amazing, and the design has it, and then on the inside there is text that elaborates on why that's particularly interesting. So it's for geeks who like to expose their bellies.
And what's the music?
The music is knob twiddling electronica. I had a record about 3 years ago, and I've done remixes since, and pitched for a few quiz show TV themes, which haven't quite struck gold yet. But
you made any ringtones yet?
I haven't made a ringtone. No, I haven't made a ringtone. I should do that.
Yeah. I'm always making ringtones, and then they annoy me. Yes. Like a minute.
I programmed one on an old Sony phone where you had to write in G sharp and program the length of the note, which I quite enjoyed the sort of mathematics of that.
Just make a whole album. and is the tap water thing got a logo and a brand?
Yeah, it does. It has both the .com and .co.uk version of GreatBritishTapWater.com. But at the moment, all that website is a logo and the email address of the two of us who are involved in it.
Right.
It will be a celebration of the wonderful tap water that we have in this country and the stories behind each of the taps from which the water comes. Particularly in this day and age when water is becoming a more precious resource, I think we should appreciate what comes out of the tap rather than what is shipped in a plastic bottle from some mountain in France.
Very good. So what's the best tap water in the UK?
Oh, well, it all depends on taste. I mean, that's the beauty of it. It varies so much.
I hated that question about cafes. So
you get used to the tap water you drink. I'll tell you what's disgusting. Yeah. I grew up drinking water from the southwest, particularly the southern part of Devon is foul, because there is not a lot of water down there. It's rainy, but it a lot of it's granite. It doesn't stick around, and a lot of it gets heavily chlorinated.
Oh.
So I quite like London water. I got used to it.
Right. I always notice when I go home. I go back to Derbyshire. Well, I say Derbyshire. Derby's not really in Derbyshire. When I go back to Derby, I just really like that. And plus, your hair's always more manageable than the east region, I find. I don't know if it's hardness or softness, presumably.
No, my geology expert would be able to tell me on that.
Yeah. Is that it? So that's all you do, you feckless, idle fop?
I think so. I lose track.
Right.
I lose track. Yeah.
And how does that? So if you stand up and talk about brands, you know, as professionally, do you get credit because you own some brands?
I think I do.
Right.
I think I get credit because I understand how to not just create those brands but run the project behind it, and perhaps the t-shirt business was the one that my clients have been most interested in, because it most closely resembled the business they were in terms of sourcing my stock and dealing with the retailers and registering my VAT number and briefly becoming a limited company. It's just the nuts and bolts stuff, the pressures of running a business, albeit it's a...
Huge HR department.
Well, I had HR issues to deal with as well when I worked with my brother on that. So it's running a business at a micro scale, albeit, you know, evenings, weekends, is not a million miles away from running a global blue chip company. Certainly not for the client. You can empathise at that level. So that they were interested in. And some of the other stuff I do, so like the music, or more recently, you know, guerrilla gardening, where I'm dealing a lot with media and talking to TV people, overlaps with a lot of the ideas we talk about in communications. Mm-hmm. How can we do something more interesting than a TV ad or a poster ad? Mm-hmm. Let's make a record. Well, if I've spent hours talking to A&R men and dealing with distribution problems because the record company aren't getting the stock out, then I'm already more familiar with the practicalities of it. Mm-hmm. The first agency I worked at described everybody in that building as a brand architect, which I like architecture, so I quite like to be called a brand architect. Mm-hmm. But actually, some of the great architects, Joseph Stein and Peter Zumter, who I'm a big fan of, they didn't start out as trained architects. They were more craftsmen, carpenters and the like. Mm-hmm. And I think that doing stuff means that when you come to do the theorising, it's easier,
right,
and more credible.
And are you able to not meddle in the doing when the doing is not your job?
Well, meddle's a loaded word.
I know.
So I would say I do meddle, but hopefully it's constructive.
Right.
And the best people I've worked with.
But are the people who see it as meddling?
There are definitely people that see it as meddling.
Right.
Unfortunately, I think some agencies are structured in a more rigid way, and they perhaps tend to be bigger agencies, but that's possibly an unfair generalisation, where people are anxious that somebody might be doing their job because then they feel that they would be redundant. But I think if everybody meddles a bit in everybody else's job, then you get better results.
Mm-hmm.
And ideally, you know, as a planner, when you're commenting on creative ideas, if the audience knows that you know about the aperture setting on a camera, or you know how to use Photoshop, then what you're saying is more realistic, it's more acceptable, it's not based on misunderstandings, rather than feeling an insecurity about that. But
it does affect your...
It does
affect the relationships, though, doesn't it?
It does. In my experiences, it either means you have fantastic relationships with those who get it and appreciate it, or disastrous relationships with creative directors who think they know much more about music and have arguments over the popularity of Boyzone and its appropriateness for ads on Capital, than with somebody who is a musician. Yeah.
Yes, I can imagine. So I mean, I believe, and I've definitely advocated, it makes it sound like anyone would care, but, you know, that the best planners are people who do stuff. But you also, I'm really struggling with this question. But you also get the sense that, as you say, there's a lot of systems in...
Yeah.
Agencies and marketing and just the way stuff is done that kind of resists that.
Yes.
Is that, would you say that was...
Definitely, that's the case. I think it's...
Are you having to build a new kind of career, do you think?
Well, I found myself in a situation being a freelancer. I don't think I would have been brave enough to jump straight into it, but I've found myself in that situation. And for me, that's working very well, because it does give me more time to be able to do my stuff and really ensure that can earn a bit of an income.
Mm.
And then my role as a planner is more valued, because I'm now specifically to do something rather than just be a permanent part of the team.
Right.
I don't think you have to be sitting you know, or being in the office 5 days a week to be a permanent part of that team. You can dip in and dip out. So that's, yeah, that, I mean, that's not a new kind of career. People have freelanced like that for a long time, but they might have, you know, been doing other stuff. But I'm not doing it to, you know, spend more time with the family. I'm doing it because it enables me to have a portfolio of interests.
It's Charles Handy all over. Are you, and do the two, I mean, the answer to this is presumably yes, but the two interrelate, presumably. You're better as a planner because of the stuff you do, and you're better at doing that stuff because you're a planner, or is,
yeah,
or is it just all you, basically?
No, I hope I'm better at being a planner because of the experience, as we said, of what I'm learning through the projects, but also mentally, I think there's the satisfaction in doing stuff.
Right.
People talk about how people are turning to knitting and plumbing because they like to get their hands dirty and actually physically create something rather than just theorise. So it's nice to be able to do that, and I wouldn't expect to necessarily do that in the office at a computer creating something in Photoshop, because there are going to be people who are better at doing it. But if I can do that as an enthusiastic amateur in my own time, then there's that satisfaction.
Do they leak into each other? Do you find yourself saying, you know, like, the perfect way to brief this project is with this photograph or with this plant, or, you know, or are they very separate?
They're not
spheres.
No, they do cross over. An example, but
the thing for me is that most planning in most agencies is a very word driven activity. You know, it's PowerPoint and Word, basically.
Yeah.
Which, and the real world, apart from books, isn't that word driven. It's things and feelings and music and blah blah blah. And a lot of the stuff you're doing is not words. So do you suddenly become a word person when you step over the agency threshold, or
I think I do a bit.
Right.
I couldn't. Yeah. I. Sorry.
I'm brilliant with words.
I'm not as much of a. I could be much more of a creative planner than I have been.
Right.
I think it's partly about being part of an agency culture where the audience expects the words.
Mm.
You know, they need the brief. If they haven't got the brief, they won't start the job.
Right.
Sort of thing. And I've not been in a position, perhaps, or not chosen to challenge that as much as I could have done.
Right.
I find, perhaps as many planners do, it's in a pitch situation where the pressure's up and people get into the room and all have a good chat and a brainstorm about it that generally are most satisfying when the systems are perhaps less important.
That's true, actually. Pitches are just the best bit.
Yeah. I think so.
You know, it's excitement without responsibility.
Yes.
Yeah. And what? So, what's the current state of play with, you know, guerrilla gardening?
Well, it's got to the point where I have plenty of plots to look after myself, and have local troops that can do the weeding and watering for me as well when I'm away. What I'm really trying to do better is get other people around the world to do it themselves, and many are now sending me photos of what they've been up to and postcodes so I can plot it on my map, and I need to update the website, but I need to improve the back-end data management. So there I found myself, where I started as a gardener, now being a data gimp, trying to program databases or find people that can, that enable this community of enthusiastic guerrilla gardeners around the world to speak to each other, to not all go through me, which at the moment is how the website works, and I have a backlog of 260 unread emails at the moment in a special filtered inbox.
Right.
So that's actually the day-to-day part of the project.
Wow.
Beyond that, I just want to keep spreading the word, and there are, in whatever media wants to talk to me about it.
Are people, because there was a burst of publicity
Well, as a shape of the campaign, I thought would be a burst,
right?
Because there was a load of newspaper coverage and an invitation onto the Rich and Judy show in January.
Uh-huh.
But what has turned out to be is it's a heavyweight drip.
So a drop.
Yeah, something like that. So I was interviewed by the Big Issue and Costing the Earth for Radio 4 last night.
Right.
And House and Gardens wanted to do a back page about me and my car, which I so far not accepted.
Why not?
Well, I was thinking I should perhaps hold that one back for when I have something more than the idea itself to promote.
Ah, very good. Very good. So what did you learn about being on the other side of the media, as it were?
I've learned that if it's a good story, as in positive news, that they won't question you, that they more or less have the story written before they've even turned up.
Right.
And you're just filling in the gaps. So as long as you're kind of in agreement, then it's really easy. It's not stressful at all.
And they're not looking for any nuance, are they? Really?
They're not looking for any nuance. You find yourself repeating yourself a great detail. A great deal.
Yeah.
They perhaps don't read the website as much as they could, where all the answers to those questions would be. The more efficient journalists never bother to even speak to me or meet me. They just write articles having read all the content on the website and put their name on it. as I believe to various... brands. I have a friend who signed up who was sitting in a meeting with Walker's media agency, I think, who were presenting photos off my website in this document, one of which included him in it. He's a planner at a big North London agency, so that was very amusing. It's just funny when you hear them popping up like that.
Yes, that's true. That is very true. And there's a thing you can feel that people seem to think the web or anything online is just kind of a resource that they can mine.
Yes.
Paying any mineral rights.
And I suppose I'm amused by that. I'm fairly relaxed about it. Because, well, with guerrilla gardening anyway, it is about just people going off and doing it.
I'm
not there to give permission.
Yeah.
That's actually the last thing I want to be doing, because then I become responsible for what they're up to.
Yeah.
So really it is just about spreading the word, and if an audience in a Walker's Crisps meeting are learning about guerrilla gardening, then great, perhaps they'll go out and do it.
lovers, breathe easy 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 lovers.
The names of speech sounds. It combines them into intelligible speech. For example, when the speech sounds of the sentence, "He saw the cat," are fed to the computer in sequence, it says,
"He saw the cat."
To obtain natural phrasing, it is necessary to add timing information to the cards. Then the computer will say,
"He saw the cat."
To obtain voice inflection, it is necessary to add pitch information as well.
He saw the cat.
The present quality of speech synthesized by the machine is demonstrated in the following recitation and song.
Bass.
Vision, dreams of passion
flowing through my mind.
And all the while I think of you.
I cry.
A very strange reaction. The more I see, the more I do.
Something like a phenomenon.
Baby,
telling your body to come along. But white lights blow away.
right, white line highway. Tell all your friends they can go my way. Pay your toll, sell your soul. Pound for pound costs more than gold. The longer you stay, the more you pay. My white lines go a long way, either up your nose or through your vein, with nothing to gain except killing your brain.
Yeah, man, that's wrong. Ugh. Now you're quiet, that's it. Here it is, that's it. And you open it and always make sure it's wound up because you need to instantly be able to take the picture.
Maya Newman never goes out without her little black box, her Lomo. She says this mass-produced Russian camera has a magic lens, producing pictures with blurred edges and a sharp focus at the center.
Creates this sort of halo effect, I don't know, this kind of circle. That's what the lens does.
Yeah, so we got a picture of an aeroplane crossing a white circle, and then there's a blue rim against that, and then it goes into midnight blue.
But if you go and look at the sky without the photograph, you just see a sky and a plane, you don't see that, so the camera does that.
The camera sort of frames things, it makes it instantly memorable.
Well, that's the thing, it creates some kind of magic. And then after shooting for a while with this camera, I start seeing the world in that way. So I'm very grateful because it makes the world much more beautiful.
You made me look at the world with different eyes.
Maya is an Israeli-born musician who now lives in London. She belongs to a punk funk band called Githead, and she's written a song to celebrate her love affair with the Lomo, her little box of magic.
Little box of magic in my hand. Little box of magic sees the world.
The song is called My LCA, short for Lomo Compact Automat. Lomo is named after the Soviet factory where it was first made, back in the days of Leonid Brezhnev, the snappily titled Leningrad Optical Mechanical Organization. Maya is just one of half a million devotees of this low-tech model, with a glass lens, no flash or zoom, and no automatic shutter. The cameras spawned a global movement, the Lomographic Society International, that now has 75 Lomographic embassies around the world, from Sweden to South Korea.
I started taking pictures of everything, just people on the streets, my friends, parts of my room, everything I saw.
I use it to sort of document pretty much every single aspect of my life.
On a tube, I love taking pictures of people sitting on a tube. They wouldn't like it if they knew, but I hold it on my lap and just go click.
The thing I think about Lomography is it got me into concentrating on, you know, the mundane, turning something really dull into just a shape with colour.
On the Lomo Society website, you can click onto an item called What the Hell is Lomography? And be swiftly initiated. Members are urged to take as many pictures as possible in the most impossible situations, from the most impossible positions. The society is open to all owners, provided they follow 10 golden rules.
Take your Lomo everywhere you go.
Use it anytime, day or night.
Lomography is not interference in your life, but a part of it.
Shoot from the hip.
Approach the objects of your lomographic desire as close as possible.
Don't think.
Be fast.
You don't have to know beforehand what you've captured on film.
You don't have to know afterwards either.
Don't worry about all the rules.
Jessel, an Australian investment banker, often takes snaps walking up Brick Lane in London's East End. In this digital age, Jessel enjoys hearing the reassuring clunk the Lomo makes when you release the shutter. Above all, he loves its simplicity.
Photography can be really geeky and stuffy, and talking about your camera and like f-stops and how much money you've spent on something, or, you know, all this sort of stuff. I really like the idea where just forget about all that and just take photos, and some of them will come out nice and have fun doing it. Yeah. I mean, sometimes you take pictures without people knowing, because that's what you want.
That's the shoot from the hip philosophy, isn't it?
Yeah. But sometimes it's nice to actually go to someone and say, hey, can I take your picture? It's very direct.
How much do you look through the viewfinder?
Not so much. If you don't look through it, you get interesting composition. You can try and sort of do it yourself, but if you do, you spend too much time and then you lose the moment.
A few years ago, Jessel had never heard of the camera, but on a weekend break in Vienna, he came across an alternative guidebook filled with eye-catching little photographs.
They were just really sort of quirky and vibrant and fun. They weren't boring pictures of sights and things like that. You know, you could sort of, they were almost alive. Smiling faces and corners of lampposts and, you know, just weird things that you don't normally see. And really colourful and bright and happy and, I don't know, patterns and just interesting stuff.
make you look at the city in a different way, you mean?
In a way, but also just the mood of them. Straight away, it sort of made you feel happy about that place.
Back in London, Jessel finally tracked down a Lomo and began taking his own pictures. It's not just the tunnel or vignetting effect that makes the 32mm Lomo lens different, but the saturated colours it produces. Many lomographers like Maya Newman reinforce this effect with cross-processing or shooting on slide film, but processing the roll as negative film.
This is Richmond Park, so again, you get the green more than normal green. You get very intense sort of green.
Yeah, it almost looks like the world through psychotropic drugs, doesn't it?
Yes, it is. It looks very druggy, so you don't have to take any drugs. You just take pictures. It is addictive, though, very addictive. You just can't stop. You always hope for that one picture that will stop you almost breathing when you see it. It's like, yes.
So you can pay attention. All the floors are different here. They're made out of different colors of marble.
Yulia Svitlova is a young lomographer in St. Petersburg, and she's giving me a tour of the city's best-known landmark, the Hermitage Museum, inside the Winter Palace.
And the rooms there have different colors. One is green, one is yellow, one is red, one is blue.
Oh, let's have a look.
Yeah, so it's a like very lomographic.
Yulia has a dream job for a lomographer. She works at a photo lab inside the museum next to the cafe and the postcard shop. So she's in one of the world's most beautiful buildings, surrounded by outstanding works of art, and she gets to process her own films for free. Like many lomographers, Yulia has her own Lomo home on the Lomo website, featuring some of her pet subjects, chandeliers, close-ups of people's feet at parties, her DJ boyfriend at the turntable, and faces of dogs. She's famous for her double exposures, when she shoots one roll and then puts it in the camera again and shoots over it. Yulia especially likes shooting over films sent to her by other lomographers and then developing the incongruous results. Palm trees from Florida growing inside a Russian Orthodox church, for example.
I think it's a great opportunity for me, like, to catch some Tokyo or some Kuala Lumpur or some Rio de Janeiro or whatever, like, places I will never go, maybe. What people, like, put their emotions and their heart in making this roll and then send it to me by post, and it takes usually about 1 month, and when I got it, and then I finally do the layer, and then, like, it's a big surprise. I told you that I'm taking a lot of pictures during my boyfriend's parties. I'm his private photographer. So this is also international swap. It's this factory window comes from France, Strasbourg.
And that's a smashed factory window.
Yeah.
It looks quite dramatic. Lots of holes in the glass.
Somehow it fits very nicely in a party. So from right side you can see DJs playing the records. And you can imagine that this window was really in a nightclub, but it isn't.
The Lomo factory was founded in 1914 to supply optical instruments to the Russian army. After the revolution, it also produced civilian goods, from the world's biggest telescope to the little LCA camera. In the 80s, almost every Soviet family had one. Matthias Fiegel, a business student from Vienna, picked up a Lomo by chance at a flea market in Prague. When he went back home and got the first rolls of film developed, his friend Wolfgang Strangsinger was stunned and envious. He wanted one too. So did all their friends. And talk of the boxy snapshot camera spread like wildfire across the Austrian capital.
And in the beginning, we got two calls in 1 week of people who said, can you help me find a Lomo? Later, it was 10 people every day who called us.
Suddenly, after a couple of months, maybe like 50, 100 people had the same camera in Vienna. And everybody was shooting with these cameras.
So we should organize something. We should do an exhibition with the pictures of all of these people, because it's just a funny idea. All of them look with the same glass eye on the world, the Lomo lens.
And so the Lomographic International Society was born. The students were making regular trips to Russia to bulk buy the cameras. And when they organized a photo exhibition in Moscow, they invited the Lomo factory managers. But since the fax was dated April 1st, the bosses dismissed it as an April Fool's joke. Sadly for Matthias, Wolfgang and their new society, the timing couldn't have been worse. The bottom had just fallen out of the domestic market because post-perestroika Russians wanted fully automatic foreign cameras. What should the Viennese lomographers do? They turned to Stephanie Tsumakaeva for advice. She's a German woman who set up a travel agency in St. Petersburg in the early 90s.
They told me that they don't know what to do because the Lomo Compact won't be produced anymore and there's so much demand on it, and they just started to create this whole society and there's so many fanatic lovers of this little camera. I said, you just have to talk to the Russians. Let's go there and talk with them. And they said, oh, they don't know, the Russians, they're so... they're always so gloomy and they're not answering to our faxes. And so I offered them to go there.
Stephanie spent weeks studying the production line at the factory. Eventually, she brokered a deal with a little help from the then deputy mayor of St. Petersburg, one Vladimir Putin. And so for 8 more years, the factory continued to export 2,500 cameras to Austria every month. But last year, production stopped again, this time for good. The business simply wasn't viable in the long term, says Stephanie.
The camera was created under Soviet conditions. At that time, it was possible to produce things very cheap, which are today only possible to produce cheap in China, because today the labor force here is not cheap anymore. For sure I feel sad about that, because it was a part of my work and my life for the last years, to be the bridge between, on one side, my Soviet uncles, Soviet-style factory managers, and on the other side, my T-shirt guys in Vienna.
Thanks to those T-shirt guys, the Lomo lives on. They're still selling reconditioned LCAs. They also design and sell a range of other cameras, like the Color Splash with tinted flash filters, the Frog Eye underwater camera, or the multi-lens delayed exposure action sampler. Most are assembled in China, but the newest model, a panoramic snapshot camera called the Horizon Compact, is made in a factory outside Moscow. These spin-offs aside, the camera's most important legacy is the way it inspired a new generation of photographers around the world. Every day, 3,000 new images are uploaded onto the Lomo site. Musicians are particularly avid fans. The Gotan Project, who play 21st century tango, recently shot a moody video in the Lomo style. Cynics say the lomography philosophy is just clever marketing. Others, like Adam Scott, a young London-based photographer, believe the Lomo has had a lasting effect on our visual culture. On a recent job, Adam found that even a healthcare company wanted the Lomo look to spice up their annual report.
We had very fixed things we had to shoot, like a surgeon, a patient, a travelling salesman. But they used them, you know, for kind of cutaway shots to break up, because there'd be a page of images of a person and then maybe just a Lomo of the guy walking. So just the legs walking down, or we've got one of, like, you know, a building and sky looking up. And annual reports by default tend to be quite boring. They're for the shareholders or whatever to look at. So it's all figures and you fall asleep by page 2. And I think that's the reason why they wanted to give the imagery a bit of an edge. They were inspired by lomography, I think, as a paradigm of photography or a style.
Shoot from the Hip, the world's coolest camera, was produced and presented by Lucy Ash. The editor was Maria Belinska.
I sure know where I'm going. Drove downtown in the rain, 9:30 on a Tuesday night, just to check out the late night record shop. Conrad and Bolson, Conrad and Bolson, Conrad insane. When I'm surrounded, I just can't stop. It's a matter of instinct, it's a matter of conditioning, and a matter of fact. You can call me Pavlov's dog. Ring a bell and I'll salivate. How'd you like that? Dr. Lindsay, tell me that I'm just a pedagogue. Cause right now I'm lying in bed, just like Brian Wilson did. Well, I'm lying in bed just like Brian Wilson did. Lying in bed just like Brian Wilson did. Well, I'm lying in bed just like Brian Wilson did. Oh. Yeah.
Thanks for listening.